This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 9 o'clock straight up. Coming next up next at 9 o'clock, Political Perspectives Show is hosted by Linda Olson Osterlund as she interviews Professor Zahair Wahab, who has just returned from 5 months in Afghanistan. The phone lines will be open for your calls in the second half of the show. At 10 o'clock, Flashpoints features more coverage of yesterday's verdict in the Bradley Manning case, including a recording of Bradley Manning's voice, which was smuggled out of the courtroom. At 11 on the radio zine, Matthew Rothschild of Progressive Magazine interviews writer and activist Bill Fletcher Jr. about why working Americans and unions have lost touch with one another and what might be done to turn that around. And at 11:30 on the radio zine, local artist Greg Wilbur and Momoko Okada Sanderson and Japanese artist Ryota Nishikata talk about East and West, the Hammered Metal Object, which opens this week at the Museum of Contemporary Craft and Waterstone Gallery.
KBOO Community Radio and Veterans for Peace Chapter 72 are proud to co-sponsor a special presentation on Thursday, August 1st at 6:30 p.m. An insider's account of Guantanamo will examine the illegality, immorality, and inhumanity of the U.S. Naval Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, with Stephen T. Wax, Chief Federal Public Defender for the District of Oregon, Laura Sandown, a U.S. Navy veteran who served at Guantanamo, and S. Brian Wilson, a longtime peace activist, among others. An insider's account of Guantanamo will take place at the First Unitarian Church, 1034 Southwest 13th Avenue in downtown Portland. Thursday, August 1st, doors open at 6:30 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The first annual Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival will take place Wednesday, August 7th and Saturday, August 10th at Park Rose High School Performing Arts Center, 12003 Northeast Shaver Street, Portland. Jim Pepper was born in Salem, Oregon and lived in the Portland area for many years. A jazz saxophone composer and singer of Native American ancestry, he became a pioneer of fusion jazz in the late 1960s. This event is sponsored by KBOO Community Radio and the Oregon Cultural Heritage Commission. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO this morning. You're listening to Report from Afghanistan on Political Perspectives, and I'm your host, Linda Olson Osterlund. As I said, our topic today is Afghanistan, the state of the country and the state of the war. My guest is Lewis and Clark retired professor of education, Dr. Zahair Wahab. After 40 years, Professor Wahab officially retired from Lewis and Clark, where he pursued his passion for teaching teachers, developing programs and curriculums for teaching around the world. Born in Afghanistan, for the last several years, Professor Wahab has traveled there to spend months at a time training Afghan teachers. He's just returned from his most recent project, and I'm very pleased to have him here in the studio today. Good morning, Professor Wahab. Welcome back to KBOO.
Thank you. Good morning, Linda, and thank you for having me.
I'm always happy to have you on the airwaves, whether I'm just listening or getting to interview you. This show is also a call-in. I want all of you listeners to know. After about 20 to 30 minutes, we'll open up the phone lines, but I do want to get a lot of information out of Professor Wahab first, and then you'll have your chance to interact with him directly. The phone number is 503 201-231-8187. You can line up ahead, but we won't be taking questions for about another 20, 25 minutes. So, Professor Wahab, I want to start right off. You just got back about a week, and I'm sure it's always a bit of a shock to go from that culture to this culture.
Indeed.
Can you tell us about the particular project you were working on in Afghanistan and where you were?
Yeah. Well, Linda, I have been going back every year for the last 12 years. I think this was maybe my 20th trip. Right. And every year I have been spending about a semester or some years, two semesters. Initially, I was a senior advisor to the Ministry of Higher Education for about 5 years, from early 2002 to 2006, where we tried to essentially rebuild the higher education system, which has been gutted like everything else in that devastated country. But for the last 6 years, I have been focusing on teaching teacher ed faculty, and not teacher trained teachers, but people who train school teachers.
So the faculty of training teachers. I know what you mean. The people who will teach future teachers.
Right. And this says something. For example, there are some 4,000 college professors in Afghanistan. Only 5% of them have doctorate degrees, and maybe another 35% have master's degrees. The rest of them, 60% of the university professors, only have bachelor's degrees. And this includes fields like medicine, engineering, journalism, you know, pharmacy, etc. So,
and states like California have more professors than 4,000.
Yeah,
well, you know, when we compare, I mean, if you actually compare the numbers, it's phenomenal.
Right. So capacity building, so-called, in education is one major challenge. The same can go for school teachers, for example. It is estimated that only 20% of the school teachers, first through 12th grade, are actually qualified, which is to say only 20% of the school teachers have a community college degree. The rest of them are high school graduates or 10th grade graduates or 9th grade graduates. So while in terms of quantity, there has been an explosion of enrollments from first grade through the university. Now maybe about 8 million school children in school and maybe another 130,000 students in public institutions of higher learning. But the quality has declined substantially. So what I've been trying to do is to teach in this one master's degree program to train teacher ed faculty so they can go back to their four-year colleges and train school teachers. And I also, for the last year, I have been teaching in another master's degree program, which trains mid-career civil servants, civic organizations, personnel, nonprofit people in public policy and administration. And what this means really is to design the curriculum, design the courses, find the material in English, of course, have it translated, edited, make it available, and teach in the local languages. So that's essentially my formal sort of job description. But of course, I have another agenda too, and that is to say, to talk to my students, talk to my colleagues about the world, the state of the country, and about world affairs in the North-South divisions, you know, the developed and the developing, the rich and the poor people, and how the developed world deliberately undermines development in the developing world.
Talk about who your students are.
Well, they're from all over the country. It is very, very interesting. The MED program has 22 people in it, 11 men, 11 women. They represent 17 four-year teacher training colleges from throughout the country. So we just graduated the fifth group, and we're processing the sixth and seventh. And amongst my students are all kinds of ethnic, religious, regional students. Yes, Hazaras, Tajiks, Uzbeks, Pashtuns, you name it. But they're essentially people in their late 20s, people who are quite aware of what's going on in the world. When I initially began teaching this program, hardly anyone could type, Linda. And now everyone can type, men and women can type, and they are computer literate. So that's how much the progress, in a way, these people have made on their own. In my other program, the Master's Degree in Public Administration, they're also mostly people in their late 20s, 10 men, 10 women, but mostly from Kabul. They work for government agencies, you know, Ministry of Justice, Ministry of Mines, the World Bank, not the World Bank, but the National Bank, for example, or they work for nonprofits or civic organizations or women organizations. And these are also people who are quite sophisticated, actually. All of my students have been very, very angry. They're very frustrated. They're very mad at the state of the country and the way foreigners meddle and deliberately keep the country sort of fractured and underdeveloped.
Well, you said they came from 17 different teachers' colleges, and I have to say, in my own imagination, I didn't know there were 17 teachers' colleges in Afghanistan. How is it that in the middle of the war, these teachers' colleges are still operating and that they're able to function at all?
Well, it's interesting. Afghanistan actually had one of the best higher education system in the whole region in South and Central Asia in the late 60s and 70s, where other people came from other countries and studied in Afghanistan. It was a very highly limited but very advanced, very, very sophisticated education system. But I think the best way to approach this would be to sort of use the 2001, the turning point when the Taliban were dislodged from power. At that point, there were only five major universities functioning in the government, in the country, and maybe 7,000 students in the higher education system. And the same could go maybe schools, K through 12th, had about less than a million students throughout the country and very few girls. This is true. But soon after the Taliban were removed from power, Afghans, the people, have a tremendous desire and thirst for education at all levels. Private schools have exploded at all levels. 5 years ago, there was not a single private university, for example. Now there are 75 institutions of higher learning, private institutions of higher learning, because although the government has 25 colleges and universities, four-year colleges and universities, it cannot absorb all of the high school graduates because there's this policy, the International Agreement on Education for All, which is to say that all school-age children should be literate by 2015. And that, of course, has created a tremendous desire and a need and a demand for education at all levels. At the same time, the government does not have enough capacity, and the international community has not been interested in prioritizing education to invest in education. But the people can see that. The people know that education is the only way to sort of build the country, build their own lives, and move forward.
So for these young people that, you know, they're in their 20s that are coming to, and they're already educated to a certain level, and as you said, sophisticated in their knowledge of the world, does it take courage to plan to be a teacher in Afghanistan? Does it take a particular kind of person to want to pursue this and stay in Afghanistan? Because I know that many people are fleeing Afghanistan as they fear the supposed ending of the war or the withdrawal.
Yes. Actually, Linda, everything takes courage. Leaving your house, leaving your office, getting on a bus, crossing the street, going shopping for food, taking your kid to the doctor, traveling, getting on a highway, driving behind somebody, all of this is risky.
I wondered about that. I want to let my audience know again that I'm speaking with Professor Zahir Wahab. He's just returned from several months in Afghanistan, and we're talking about his project teaching, but we're also moving into the general conditions in the country at this stage.
This morning there was a piece on NPR, for example. This year has been the most violent, and I see this. I sense it. I could feel it when I go back.
And what town are you in? Are you in Kabul?
We're in Kabul, of course. course, sometimes we're allowed to go outside, but we can only travel by air, for example. So I work for this project, you know, and we live in a guest house for international. There are eight, nine of us, and we have our office. I am not allowed to step outside the door from my house, from my office, or from my class without the bodyguard.
Wow.
And I'm not allowed to, for example, sit in a certain place in the project SUV. So when you said, teaching is not very attractive, and this is a big problem because teachers are very poorly paid. They may be paid from 100 to 300 maximum, school teachers. College professors are paid from, say, 300 to 800 per month, dollars maximum. And at the same time, life is becoming very expensive. But the other thing is that currently, anyone who is associated with the government is a target in a way. Whether you're a police person, whether you're a teacher or a government, cabinet minister or an army officer or whatever. But sometimes also you could just be a victim of random violence. There are explosions all the time, all over the place, and you never quite know that the person riding, driving next to you, behind you, or in front of you, if the car is packed with explosives. So
I know this sounds funny, but I can only imagine that hypertension is off the scale there in terms of health care. When you're in a state of continuous fear, though, there is a level of anxiety that your body will be responding to, and that causes all sorts of health difficulties just in by itself, just that hidden level of anxiety. Even if you don't change your actions, it's inside you.
I think my reaction, honestly, this time when I returned, because as I said, this year has been the most violent.
Yes.
Where both the insurgent attacks on the U.S. NATO forces and or the government security forces and vice versa has been the highest. There have been more than 3,000 insurgent attacks on NATO U.S. forces and the Afghan troops. From
we're
the NPR
barely
report,
over half a year through.
About 1,500 civilians killed, and 1 in 5 of those civilians are children. So, but there's no Malala Yousafzai amongst the Afghan children because, they were killed in a war, which is, I think, a misnomer. So, so this year has been the most violent. You know, there were 6 or 7 spectacular attacks in Kabul itself, not very far from where I lived and worked. One of the attacks, these people got at the gate of the presidential palace in the CIA headquarters.
Yes, they actually.
And that makes you think.
Yes, it's very, and clearly it's heating up in a very dramatic way.
Indeed.
Talk about why. Give us your assessment of what exactly is happening there now.
Well, for the last year or so, the U.S., NATO have been talking about leaving, which is a lie. Robert Blake from the State Department, Commander Dunford, just today, actually, and other people have been saying, and James Dobbins, who is a special representative to Pakistan and Afghanistan, all three of these have said in the last week that we are not leaving this region, not just the country, but the region. As I have said,
you're mentioning 2017. I just had to say that. I heard Dunford say, and let's throw out, they're all of a sudden throwing out the number 2017,
Yes, it was 2014. So, they have been talking in a way to extract agreements because, if I have always maintained, and many people have maintained, that the issue is not co-terrorism or Al-Qaeda. In fact, Dunford himself said the other day that at best there may be 75 Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
But then he went on to say, but you can be sure we're going to continue to go after them.
It's rather
weird. I thought,
weird.
How many million dollars per person, billion dollars per person are we going
to
put
to
on?
To get 75 So the issue has never been in my mind Al-Qaeda or terrorism or bringing freedom to Afghan women or doing away with narcotics or rebuilding the state and the government in the country. These are simply used as alibi. They're used as excuses. The issue is the minerals, the riches, the oil, the gas, the markets, the labors, not just of Afghanistan, but of all of Central Asia and South Asia. That is the agenda. And, you know, the United States in a fierce competition with China, India, Russia, and other countries, the United States would never leave. Otherwise, why are they building 9 big bases? Yeah. And why is the U.S. building the second largest building after the Pentagon, the Ministry of Defense in Kabul itself, right across the palace? They're finishing up. They're going to move in a month or so. It's the second largest Ministry of Defense in the world after the Pentagon.
Well, you know, when you paint that picture, Professor Wahab, I see this U.S. involvement in the future, you know, going into 2017, and maybe we'll call it NATO involvement as well, you know, with these, you know, the 9 permanent bases. I'm sure some of those are drone bases or have drone bases within them.
Yes.
And then this huge building in Kabul. And yet the rest of the infrastructure of Afghanistan is not built up. I can't imagine how many literally billions of dollars are going into the building of the maintenance of these bases, which cannot even necessarily be defended against the Taliban
or
insurgents, whoever it was who went into Kabul. And yet you see the rest of so much of Afghanistan is really horrible conditions. So talk about that juxtaposition. Yeah. Talk about what the rest of Afghanistan looks like.
Well, look at, since October 2001, the world community has spent at least $1 trillion on the war. And the world community has given $90 billion for development to the Afghan government. Most of that money went to for training the army, the police, and the intelligence. But let's say $20 billion or so went to development. But education, healthcare, agriculture, which are the primary sectors in the Afghan society and life and could be means for development and livelihood, were never prioritized. So they have makeshift projects. So at this point, the Minister of Economy the other day, Mr. Arghandiwal, was saying that half of the Afghan labor force is unemployed or underemployed. Most Afghans are poor. Most Afghans still live, as we speak, on $1 or $2 a day. And Afghanistan is insecure. And from every index, you know, it's toward the very bottom of the development scale. At the same time, you have these, you know, drones, you have the military hardware, you know, you have bases, you have outposts. Some of them are being, and the stupidity of it is that right now, as we speak, the United States, the Pentagon, is spending $2 billion to wreck and scrap $7 billion worth of military hardware. Right there. At the same time, the Afghan forces that they're expecting to defend the country don't have bullets. They don't have shoes. They don't have medevac things. They don't have helicopters, for example. So you can see, I mean, the illogic of this lopsided development. So many
talk
people,
about the forces that are at play inside Afghanistan. Who is fighting who? I mean, 75 Al-Qaeda are not the, quote, insurgents that made it to Kabul. Talk about the Taliban and the pre-peace talks that are going on in Qatar. And is that really who is all fighting? Is it different wings of Taliban fighting each other again?
The Afghan situation has become very complicated. We can't really speak in terms of a country or a nation. There are countries within a country. There are nations within a nation. There are capitals within the capital. People are segmented. Kabul is like Baghdad. So you have the Shiites, the Sunnis, the Panjshiris, the Pashtuns, the Tajiks, etc., living in their own enclaves. And you have several presidents in a way. You have co-presidencies where the vice presidents are as powerful as the president. All of them, of course, Rentier, all of them on the CIA, ISI, and Iranian pay for the last umpteen years. And then you have the mafias. You have the land mafia, for example, which is an Afghan. You have the drug mafia, which has an Afghan branch, but also international branch. You have the timber mafia. You have the human trafficking mafia.
When you talk of them as mafias, you mean they're organized criminal syndicates that are defending, and they have armies.
They have armies. They have militias. They're in many ways better equipped than the local police, for example. They have prisons. People disappear in broad daylight. So the point is that this war, unfortunately, or fratricide, I should say, continues because so many people who could stop and end this war are not interested in ending it. The Americans are not interested. You know, Cal Poly, the former British ambassador, wrote a book when his term was over in Kabul, the Kabul Cables. And he said, as far as he's concerned, the United States government is the main obstacle to peace and settlement in Afghanistan. And Nick Carter, the deputy commander of the U.S. NATO forces, who's British, whose term just ended, he said that we should have talked to the Taliban at the Bonn Conference in December 2001. And our ambassador, former Ambassador Crocker, said in a speech recently, he said, we shouldn't just be barging into these countries without thinking the consequences. So there are so many external and internal forces. I mean, there's the weapons industry. You know, war is big business, as I said. The $1 trillion that was spent, that money went to, for example, Boeing, Lockheed, you know, Kellogg, Brock & Roos, for example, Halliburton, Blackwater, DynCorp. I mean, you know, it's a big war is big business, and there's a lot of money to be made. And then just one minute. So it's not just the Taliban, although the Taliban are the major resistance force. But there are also other groups, vested interests, who want this bloodshed, this mayhem, this war, this fratricide to continue because, again, there's power, privilege, and money involved. And you know, people have gotten the taste of it, and they're not going to relinquish.
Well, you know, just yesterday I was reminded that Karzai's brother, I believe, was caught leaving the country. One of the cables from WikiLeaks revealed with $53 million in his bags, and they determined to just allow it to go. They didn't know for sure where it was from.
But. So here, the thing is that on the one hand, there's this talk about the U.S. NATO leaving. On the other hand, they're building permanent bases. We know they're not leaving. But the other thing is that I think what the U.S. wants is to reduce the footprint, the visible footprint. We also need to remind people that there are 110,000 U.S. NATO allied forces right now, including people, troops from New Zealand or Norway or Jordan or UAE, who are not part of the of the NATO and were never attacked by anybody from Afghanistan. So there are troops from 45 different countries. And then you have 100,000 plus contractors from the United States, from third countries, and from Afghanistan.
Are those mostly support structures, or are those also combatants?
They do the fighting, some of them. They're combat, too, for example. They're the ones who put the payload, the weapons on the drones. You know, there were more than 500 drone attacks last year. They're also the ones who do intelligence work. You know, like people like Blackwater, which is now called Academia, I think, which is interesting. You know, they do whatever, because the war is also being subcontracted. You know, they do intelligence, they do fighting, they do support, quote unquote, they advise, they train, they do this and that. So
favorite employers of the former SEALs.
Yes. You know, there are a lot of groups involved, and there's no real consensus. But at the same time, I think the resistance in the opposition senses that the NATO-US, notwithstanding all the talk and the bragging, essentially have lost the war, and they're on the run. And this is time for them to gain and maintain territory and spread their influence. But also, there's supposed to be this impending talk in Qatar between, you know, the Afghan government, the Taliban, and the United States, on and now off, for example. And so the opposition, the insurgents, really see an opportunity sort of to strengthen their position. So when they bargain with the Afghan government in the United States, they will be in a stronger position.
And I think there was also a raid on a prison, and that was part of that. I think, yes, strengthening their bargaining position. Well, you know, we're almost halfway through the show. This is Linda Olson-Osterlund for Political Perspectives. We're having a show called Report from Afghanistan. You've been listening to our guest, Professor Zahir Wahab, who just returned from Kabul, where he has been training people to train teachers. We are going to open up the phone lines now, so I want to let you know that you can call in and talk to Professor Wahab yourself, weigh in on the war, ask a question, something you've been dying to know about there. The number is 503 231-8187. It's always best when we get to hear from you, the listener. You're so well informed. I'm always impressed with what you have to say, but it also is the way that we get to connect here at KABU with those that our audience, and we really do want to hear from you, so I do mean it. Pick up that phone at 503-231-8187 and have a chance to talk to Professor Wahab about what's happening in Afghanistan. So, Professor Wahab, I have been saying this. I interviewed Jeremy Scahill, who did the book Dirty Wars.
Yes.
And
yes.
I asked him this question. I don't remember if I was able to ask it on air or after, but did he believe that the United States intended for the areas of Somalia to be failed states, that we go in every once in a while pretending to either fight some al-Qaeda affiliate or, you know, we've been doing this since the 60s, well before al-Qaeda, so we had one reason or another to go in with military, but we always managed to pick the wrong side or the side that's going to provoke the most trouble, like Ethiopia or, you know, where, you know, old-time enemies. And so I have looked at it and thought, well, you know, the U.S. and the international oligarchy, global wealth, if you would say, benefits from states being in a failed state status, basically not being able to coalesce into a government, that it opens up all of their resources as well as allows the war-making industry to make more war and make all the money you were talking about that the war-making industry makes. Yes. But beyond that, there are the resources of the countries. So I want to weigh in on that.
Well, I would say Afghanistan, unfortunately, would be an excellent case study in underdevelopment by design.
Yes.
And not just how to underdevelop and why, but also how to wreck a society, a culture, and a way of life. And the way it worked is that soon after the Taliban were dislodged, and they tried to negotiate, if we can remember, the Taliban wanted to avert, you know, a confrontation with the United States and an invasion and occupation by the United States, but the United States already had decided the previous summer that they were going to invade.
I can remember the propaganda that came out, and maybe some of it very well earned in terms of the treatment of women and beheading and all of this kind of stuff, but it really was quite a wave of propaganda.
The beheading has gotten
it.
Worse, and it's not just done by the Talib. So what it did, the United States and the world community, the UN, the European Union, the United States, what they did was to intervene in a civil war. I mean, Afghanistan was in a state of civil war, the Pashtun versus the non-Pashtuns or North versus South, and the United States decided in Bonn that they would intervene on behalf of the Northern Alliance. So the government was selected by the European Union, the UN, and the United States in Bonn, Germany. Many of these people were unknown people. All of them, most of them were criminals, thieves, assassins, you know, and spies. And they were put on a plane and landed in Kabul and imposed a government, you know, on the country. And the people did not ask for these people. They didn't vote for them. They didn't know in many of the cases. So that government, the power structure was shifted to, essentially was turned over to, the government was turned over to a criminal, you know, unpatriotic, you know,
self-serving entities.
Entity, and that has been stayed. And those people have not allowed. That's why there has been no real political development or democracy building or state building. As I said, essentially there's no functioning government in Afghanistan because these people are not capable. They don't have the interests, and they don't have the will, and they don't have the know-how. And yet they have a lot of power.
And when there were people who got into the government, like Malalai Joya,
woman, they were
I think she was a woman among warlords. They were marginalized,
and
at the same time that the United States government says that it supports women there, they don't support women who oppose the U.S. government being there. So they did not continue to support Malalai Joya.
Well, or the women in general, for example. So
well, let's take a caller though.
Fine.
I know we could talk forever about this. I promise, but we do have a caller on the line. It's Joe. Joe, go ahead. Welcome, Joe. You're on the air? For some reason.
Not.
There we go. Hello? We heard something, but sorry, Joe, if you were there and we let you go. Please do call in. We'll get faster to the next call.
So the way to do this, you know, why and how, I would say, we're talking about the accumulation of wealth, both at the national level and also at the international level. You know, wealth increasingly becoming concentrated in this country, but also globally, wealth is being concentrated amongst the 20% of the global population, with 80% of the global population struggling. And Afghanistan is sitting on, you know, incredibly precious, expensive, important strategic minerals, oil, gas, lithium, copper, gold, you name it. You know, so it's a gold mine, you know, to be excavated. But you can't allow, under these conditions, you can't quite allow an autonomous, independent people's government to work for its own people. And that's why, you know, the United States has no trouble working with these people in Afghanistan that it put in power and protects with American lives, American dollars, because these people will not challenge a U.S. Western hegemony, and they will continue to serve Western American interests, for example. And they say, we're very happy to receive payments from the CIA. Karzai himself said that in a press conference,
I've
for example.
It, where he openly talked about that those payments
so
made such a difference to him.
Imagine your National Security Council, like if our National Security Council here were being paid by the Cuban government or the Northern Caribbean, the president said, we're very thankful to the North Koreans.
And we're so assured of their position in power in the sense that they're put there by force that they felt that they could say something like that publicly.
So let me
tell the phone number again. Yeah. So the number to call in and get in on this conversation is 503-231-8187. Once again, that's 503-231-8187. Call in, ask any question you want about Afghanistan. Also, weigh in on what we're doing there, solutions that you want to see. So, you know, when we talk about the forces of the Taliban, I was reading yesterday that one of the big battles going on is that the Taliban wants all of the representatives that are going to be allowed to be participating in this to be loyal to Mullah Omar. And if I recall, isn't he a famous warlord? Yeah. You know, I mean, he's a bad guy, a really bad guy. And yet we are now once again working hard to get him in power.
Well, you know, I mean, for one, no one has really seen. People don't know if Mullah Omar is alive
and
where he
is.
He might be. But he was the head of state, so to speak.
In the
theocracy
northern.
Throughout the country, in almost 95% of the country by December 2001. I mean, they almost had the whole country. So no one knows. But at the same time, today's Taliban are not the same as, say, the Taliban of the 2001 or the 1990s, for example. The Taliban now, their representatives, some of them are in the government now, you know, in the Kabul government or in the even Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission. The Taliban just opened a university for women only in Kabul.
The Taliban?
Yes. They run the university.
This is very interesting, isn't it?
They have schools now, but also they use the media. And also, I think it's a mistake to sort of lump them together as a monolith. I mean, there are Talibs and then there are Talibs. Some of them are obviously fascistic, reactionary, you know, fanatic. But many of them quite understand the world that, you know, they have to work with different segments of the population.
Let's hold it right there. That we'll go further with that. But we do have a couple callers. Joe, come on in.
Good morning. Can you hear me this time?
Yes. We can.
Okay. It was a couple years ago, there was a presentation that I observed on local cable access TV, and it was put on, I believe, if I remember correctly, by the League of Women Voters, and the keynote speaker was a naval officer. He had on his full naval officer's uniform. I'm not sure what his name was or what his rank was, but I'm sure he was up there somewhere. But he was given a kind of a show-and-tell demonstration to these League of Women Voters. And I may have that wrong, too. It may have been Willamette Women's Democrats, but I'm pretty sure it's League of Women Voters. But he was doing his own show-and-tell there, and he had his map up there and graphs and charts and stuff. And one of the things he talked about was, he said, this is where most of the world's, he pointed to the Afghanistan region there, and said, this is where most of the world's lithium lies, where we need lithium to make our lithium ion batteries for our computers, et cetera.
True.
And so it sounds like we're not going to be out of there for a long time until we get all of the treasures robbed out of Afghanistan.
Very true.
Thank you for that point, Joe. Tell us a little bit more about the mineral resources that are in there.
I mean, the U.S. Geological Survey did surveys in the 1970s, early 1970s. The Russians have done detailed surveys, and now there have been new surveys. And you may remember Petraeus, our illustrious general, also announced.
General Philanderer.
One reason why the American six generals, commanders, have sort of lost their jobs in Afghanistan. It's sort of a graveyard for generals, too, which included General Allen, Petraeus, McChrystal, Barno, McNairy, and so forth. But anyway, it's a known fact that Afghanistan does indeed have enormous supplies of lithium, uranium, copper, which the Chinese have signed the contract, the $4.5 billion copper excavation about 40 miles from Kabul itself, when the Americans are fighting gold, silver. J.P. Morgan actually is working on gold mining, gas and oil.
So let me ask you, are there mines in lithium? Are there uranium mines? Are there mining going on right now?
Very little. Contracts are being signed, but that's also a different story because the contracts are rigged. And, for example, when the Chinese got this contract for copper for $4.5 billion, the largest in Afghanistan apparently has the second largest copper and the best copper in the world.
Well, and we took down we took down the nation of Chile for copper.
Yes.
When Allende was in power, I can see what you're saying.
Yeah, so the point is that, there are indeed all these very precious minerals, and oil and gas. But it's not just Afghanistan. It's also the Caspian Sea in Central Asia. And there's always this talk about the TAPI pipeline, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, India, and Pakistan, where they will access the Central Asian oil and gas and channel it through Afghanistan, through the Indian Ocean and so forth. So, as I said, it's about money. It's about resources. It's about market. It's about the accumulation of capital. As to what happens to the Afghans or the Pakistanis or Yemenis or Somalis or Syrians or Egyptians, that's not our business. I agree with the caller, and as I said, the United States has no interest in leaving that part of the world, and they have said it more than once.
So we have another call. Thank you very much, Joe, for that call. We have another caller. Barry, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hello.
I better put the radio down. Professor Wahab, welcome back to Portland, and I appreciate what you're doing. But
thank you.
But there was somebody that was captured by the Taliban, and he was nearly killed, and he escaped. He got back to the United States, but he never talk about the Taliban. And who was it that not the vice? Vice President, so he was kept from talking about them. Apparently, the Taliban are in there. That no one can seem to think of a reason for them being there, but any of the wrong that they do, they're in there to fight the injustice, the whole injustice that's overtaken Afghanistan. Is that right?
Well, they're in there. It's their country, And I can say to you that it's not just the typical cartoonish Talib, with sandals and beard and black or white turban. I would say the mindset, the attitudes and values of most Afghans are very aligned with the Taliban. That is to say, they're fairly religious, although not fanatic. Afghanistan is not a fanatic Muslim country. But the Afghans are fierce nationalists. So I would say the Taliban, whatever their sort of ideological, religious proclivities, are first and foremost nationalists, and they want their country back, and they keep saying that we have nothing against the United States or the U.S. government or the U.S. people or the West, and they have said it that we will not allow anybody to attack anybody from Afghan soil. And the Taliban never attacked you know, had nothing to do with 9/11. You know, it was an imposed guest who committed a crime, and now, you know, we're punishing a whole country. So, you know, what they want is to be left alone so that they can build their own country in their own way. But that seems to be unacceptable, as we see in Egypt, for example. First, we ask for democratic elections, and then when the people elect somebody, when we don't like them, we just create an Egyptian Pinochet to overthrow an elected. So that's the story. And I think, you know, the Taliban now have said more than once that they're willing to negotiate and to talk, and it looks like the United States has been forced, actually, to, after 12 years of death and destruction and mayhem and wasting thousands of American and Afghan lives, is ready to talk to the Taliban. And Karzai, of course, in his criminal syndicate, which we sponsored and which we protect, also is forced, actually, to come to terms. But ultimately, I think, you know, the world community, if it cannot be a force for good, at least it should get out of the way so that the Afghans can solve their own problems amongst themselves. There are a lot of wonderful, decent, intelligent, very progressive, forward-looking, liberated Afghans in the diaspora, but also in Afghanistan. And I meet these people, I talk to them, I teach some of them. You know, there are a lot of good. This is not a desert. It's not a wasteland. I think to say that the Afghans would need, you know, some kind of a big daddy or, you know, a big brother to build is sort of, that's a Western sort of stereotype, because not only are we not doing that, but in fact, as I keep saying, Afghanistan is a classic case study in underdevelopment by design. An example of that is, for example, Kabul still doesn't have traffic lights.
That's a very good point, Zahir. Yes. I just wanted to go ahead and say thank you, Barry, and give other people a chance to call. I want to remind you that the number is 503-231-8187. We do have another caller on the line. And it's Mitch. Mitch, thank you for calling in.
No, thank you for doing the program and having the discussion. I remember working in the alternative press in the 1980s when the black budget was still in force to after expelling the Russians from Afghanistan and after having people like Brzezinski under Carter and then the Reagan years recruiting all sorts of lunatics to Afghanistan to conduct never-ending jihad, that the Civil War broke out when the Russians were expelled.
Yes.
Now, during the years of Civil War, when the Taliban rose to sort of take dominance over the previous freelance warlords like Hekmatyar that were America's agents there, and then the American agents turned on America. There were a number of years during the Clinton years when all the progressive media in the United States claiming to speak on behalf of the Islamic world was saying that the problems with the Civil War are the result of America leaving without investing in Afghanistan. And if only America, after kicking the Russians out, would have stayed in this Islamic country and would have invested, things would have been, we wouldn't have seen the Civil War. And I just could never get anyone in the progressive journalistic community in America to see the obvious contradiction in this. The Islamic world will criticize the West for not being there, and then they will turn around and criticize the West for being there.
Yes.
Well, and let's talk about the way that let's go ahead, Professor Ahab, talk about the different ways that we would be involved.
Progressive, these terms, you know, MoveOn, .org, etc., these things, frankly, don't mean much to me at all. Every time I come back to this country, I am just astonished at the indifference of most Americans, regardless of their labels, you know, or party affiliation or this and that. It's incredible to see how self-absorbed, self-indulgent, self-righteous most Americans are, and how we don't care about other people's pain and suffering, for example, when our government, with our tax dollars, is involved in more than 70 different countries. We are involved now in Syria and in Egypt. We are up to our eyeballs in Afghanistan and Pakistan, for example, or Somalia, Yemen, you name it. It's a matter of definition. It's I think Petraeus once said, the issue is not what the facts are, but the issue is perception management. So the ruling elite in America is quite adept, and it seems to get away with it, of managing American public opinion, for example. So now in Afghanistan, if we leave, what will happen to the Afghan women? Well, why don't you ask the Afghan women to say, do you want these foreigners? I can tell you this. Most foreigners now, even the ones who are paid by the Americans, like our cooks, our drivers, our bodyguards, our gardeners, etc., truly despise and detest most foreigners. But they're made dependent, so they're like made into children. But also, for example, these night raids, these drone bombings, the random killings, for example, have widowed countless women in Afghanistan. Afghanistan now has the largest percentage of widows or orphans or amputees or asylum seekers or people who are trying to get out. So if the U.S. NATO presence or allied presence has been a good thing, why are people leaving? A more interesting and amazing thing was that 2 or 3 weeks ago, the Minister of Foreign Affairs asked most of the diplomats from Afghanistan abroad to come back for some orientations and reassignments. After 105, five diplomats showed up in Kabul. 100 diplomats decided not to. This happened about a month ago.
Were they afraid they'd end up being reassigned instead?
No, they don't want to go back because there is such an insecurity. And this, in spite of the $1 trillion, 32,200 Americans and dead, and 130,000 Afghans dead.
I also think the issue after we were in there supporting the Mujahideen, what people were saying is we should have stayed after there. There were two different ways that people were saying we should have stayed there. There were those who would have liked to see U.S. force grow more, those from that direction, and there were those who said who wanted to see greater development activities.
But neither
take
has
place,
happened,
and neither did take place. So I think the issue isn't do you want to have an occupying force or not, but do you want the occupying force that's leaving to have, you know, and still develop, put money into development?
Well, some people have calculated that this aid part, the development part, the nation building part of the international community, if this money had been distributed in Afghanistan, there would be peace, tranquility, development, and democracy all over the country, and there would be no fighting, no reason for it. But now the money comes and money goes. For example, last year, $4.5 billion left in cash through the Kabul airport. Right now, there's a massive exodus of people and money.
$4.5 billion in cash left,
yes.
Afghanistan.
That's two-thirds of the government's budget. The government's budget is $6 billion. The issue is not to know whether we should stay. I mean, what gives the United States or any country the right to say, to go occupy and invade people in one way or another? I think the issue is leaving people alone, respecting people's sovereignty, independence, autonomy, self-determination, and leaving people alone to build their own societies, their own economies, their own polities, their own education, their own culture in the way they want to.
Their own resources.
If people think that, Petraeus is going to liberate Afghan women or Bush or Obama, for example, people need to think about that, because I don't see these people as feminists or liberators. There are Afghan women who are struggling. There are Afghan men and women who are risking their lives. People get executed. They get, killed. They get assassinated. They disappear. They get maimed because they're fighting for their own, self-development and for national autonomy. So I think the idea would be to just leave people alone and see what happens to societies, because people are quite capable of, you know, managing their lives. And then if we can help, maybe we should just help through economy, skills, technology, and so forth. But you don't develop a society by bombing it.
That's right. Well, thank you for your call. We have time for a few more callers. It's 503-231-8187. Please give us a call and tell us what you think about what's going on in Afghanistan and how you feel about the lack of anti-war activity in general that's going on in our country. We've been at war for over 12 years in Afghanistan, and people are suffering here at home from lack of resource development in the U.S. infrastructure as well. Cities go bankrupt, exactly. And yet we're spending literally billions and billions of dollars.
$10 billion a month. $10 billion a month.
On building 9 permanent bases, really on trying to maintain Afghanistan as an open market for the rest of the world's plunder. I agree with you that I think that's what we're doing. We're doing it to many other nations. Professor Wahab, can you take a moment to go into the connection between what we're doing in Afghanistan and what's happening in Syria? I know you mentioned that in one of your letters, and I want to hear a little bit more about that.
I think, the history of the U.S. foreign policy, as many astute observers have stated, has been quite consistent, and that is it's colonialism, it's imperialism, old and or new, throughout the world. We saw it in Latin America, the Caribbean, Central America. We saw it in Africa. We saw it in the Middle East, for example. I think the United States simply cannot stand governments or leaders who would not serve U.S. interests. And if that means working with Al-Qaeda, so be it. We know for a fact, for example, that the United States worked with Al-Qaeda in the opposition in Libya because the U.S. didn't like Gaddafi because he was too appetite, and he was, one of the founders of OPEC. And the United States would never forgive that and never forgave. So the United States had no trouble working with Al-Qaeda in Libya, and it has no trouble now working with Al-Qaeda and other fanatics in Syria. Because
and yet it's still
Syrian
going
opposition.
After the 75 that are left, according to the general yesterday in Afghanistan.
And it's confused about that, So the Hafiz said, in the Syrian government, which was a close ally in a way of Iran and Russia, for example, but also kind of appetite and autonomous. And so the U.S. cannot stand the thought of anyone standing up to the United States and saying, just leave us alone. And that's why I think, and the same, I think, with Egypt. All this, remember the hype about the Arab Spring in the U.S. media, progressive or non-progressive. And now there's hardly any mention of that, you see. So I think the United States, the ruling elite, has its own interests, and that's corporate interests. It's imperialism sort of in a new garb. And, and then it chooses. Who is going to obstruct our agenda throughout the world? Who is going to be cooperative? And we will work with those who will cooperate. I mean, we lied. We lied and destroyed Iraq. Look at what the U.S. did to Iraq. 1,000 people get killed this minute, for example, in a month.
Yeah, the war has never ended in Iraq.
We wrecked it, and we're doing the same thing to Afghanistan by fracturing it, by fragmenting it, by polarizing it, by gangsterizing it, by criminalizing it. And the same thing, I'm afraid, will happen to Afghanistan, unless we're lucky.
Let me ask you a different question then. You talk very bluntly about this, and you talk straight forwardly and with a lot of authority because of your history and because of you working in Afghanistan. Do you ever worry about that? Are you ever encouraged by, do you ever feel that any concern about speaking out, that will end up limiting your activities or getting you in trouble in some way in the future?
Are we engaged in espionage now? Are we undermining national security? Are we aiding the enemy? So
you've been listening to all the news around Manning and
I have always assumed for some time now, I have assumed that we live in a quasi-police state here in this country, and that we're really not sovereign citizens, informed, involved, engaged, responsible, sovereign, trusted, respected citizens. But I have, honestly, I have had no indication of given any kind of, I'm you know, what I'm saying is I took from the New York Times or NPR.
Well, sure,
NPR.
Yes, you're not.
So, or, you know, PBS and this and that, or Amy Goodman. If something happens, it could happen, I suppose, but I can't dwell on it. I mean, yeah, you have to stick to your principles. There are things in life struggling for and fighting for, and the pain, the suffering, the anguish, the uncertainty, the mayhem that I witness every year for 4 months at least is unbearable. You know, I mean, it's unconscionable. I don't know how I can live a normal life without speaking on behalf of the voiceless, the peasants, the women, the children, the men, the poor people, a country that was a decent, self-supporting, self-sufficient, self-reliant, a peaceful country now turned into a war zone. It's hard not to speak. Whatever might happen could happen, you know.
But the speaking has to happen, and I thank you very much for that.
But where is the rage? Where are the Americans?
And you know, I know you are a loving man, and I know that you have many American friends and people that you care about deeply, and yet you talk about the indifference that you see in America right now, and we only have like 1 minute left, but how do you think we can impact that indifference? I don't think it's a genuine indifference. I think it's a way that we've reflectively learned to deal with things that we feel are out of our control or out of our sight.
Well, in some ways, yes and no. But, you know, I mean, we in this country, we have been brought up and educated and socialized to assert our individuality, our humanity, our sense of righteousness, you know, to make demands on people that are supposed to govern society. I think part of it is a cop-out, people saying, I can't do anything. People tell me, oh, it's so nice you're doing something from your homeland. And I say to them, but this is my homeland too. I have two homelands, and I'm concerned about both. I worry about both, and I try to help both of them. I think what citizens need to do is to put pressure on the ruling class in this country, and what Cornel West said, you know, the war president, the drone presidents, the plantation president, and a war criminal. I mean, I think what American citizens must do to put pressure on the ruling elite to reprioritize both our national, domestic, and our foreign policy, to be a force for good. And I think Americans need to control their own lives, and that is say, not to be as greedy, not to be as wasteful, not to be as self-indulgent, and not to live like grown-up children. I mean, you know, exercise some sense, some logic, some humanity, some ethics. You know, where are the ethics? You know, this is what people can do, and ultimately governments will change because, you know, we still have a sort of a nominal democracy in this country, although it's a plutocracy. But if enough people resist, you know, the government will behave differently, and that's what we must do.
Yes, I agree with you very much. And thank you so much for coming on KBOO today,
you.
Professor Zahir Wahab. I want to thank all of you who called in, and I want to thank you, the listening audience. I'm hoping that you'll take the words from today and think of some way that you can immediately take action on behalf of the people of Afghanistan and getting us off. I know there are great websites like Witness for Peace and others, so please do take whatever action you can take, including sharing this show with other people. It'll be uploaded to the KBOO website within just a few hours, and you can go to that and share it on your Facebook or via email to others. Let other people hear what you heard today, and thank you for listening to KBOO.
Yeah. Thank you, Linda.
You're welcome.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. Air Cascadia is off today, so coming up next at 10 o'clock is Flashpoints, featuring yesterday's coverage of the Bradley Manning case, including a recording of Bradley Manning's voice.
Pickathon is an innovative music experience happening from Friday, August 2nd through Sunday, August 4th, just outside of Portland at the beautiful Pendarvis Farm. This one-of-a-kind weekend of music, food, and community features performing artists Sharon Van Etten, The Devil Makes Three, Sally Ford and The Sound Outside, The Foghorn String Band, and many, many more. Information about tickets, camping, and other performers can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.